This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity and Business Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by a brilliant author, writer, thinker, Zachary Karabell. Zachary's recently authored a new book called Inside Money. He's going to take a moment to tell us about himself, tell us about the book, and then a lot more. Zachary, can you take a moment, tell us about yourself, tell us about the book.
So the tell us about yourself questions, I always find way more complicated than, where's America going? What's the shape of the world? What's the nature of the investment management industry? But the thumbnail is I've had a multi-decade career as both a writer and before that an academic, and then also in the investment business. And the book that I just wrote, Inside Money, Brown Brothers Harriman, and The American Way of Power, is probably the best marriage of those two aspects of my career over the decades. I've done a few other books that bring my experience in the financial world together with my academic background as an historian, but this is probably the most pure iteration of at least those particular halves of my career.
And take a moment down Brown Brothers Harriman, one of the famous sort of investment banks, merchant banks. Tell us a little bit about Brown Brothers Harriman. I'm old enough to remember hearing about them a decent amount, but talk to us a little bit about Brown Brothers Harriman.
Right. So I think Brown Brothers Harriman is probably the most important financial institution that most people have never heard of. Or if they've heard of it, it's some like distant vestigial memory of, weren't they once ... without actually realizing that they are still a thriving private partnership, lucrative and in business today globally, albeit not doing any of the quote unquote sexier aspects of the financial world, right? They're not a hedge fund, although they have an investment management business. They're not an investment bank. So they don't really do flashy deals, although they certainly facilitate other people doing deals. But they've been around since 1800. They actually say they've been around since 1818, but I think it's more accurate to say that they've really been around ever since the patriarch of the firm, Alexander Brown, who was an Irish linen merchant, fled the sectarian troubles of Ireland in the 1790s to relocate in Baltimore, and then brings his four sons into his merchant business, which was really as an importer and exporter, and eventually the most important cotton merchant in the United States, as Brown Brothers. And at every crucial juncture of American financial history, and in many ways of American history, there is a Brown Brothers banker sort of looming in the background quietly, not wanting to be front and center, not wanting to be the story, but without whom there really isn't a story. And I thought this was a fascinating lens to view the rise of the United States, the rise of the dollar, the rise of the American economy in the 19th century, and how the men, and they were all men, and they were all white men, and they were mostly Protestant white men, how that cohort then made the global system of the 20th century, and where that leads us today.
And how did they play into sort of that? I know you mentioned it, but they were one of the most, famous financiers in the cotton business. How does that play in today's world with this lens of, post the 1860s, post slavery, but so many historic issues still very, very much at play and very much in the mind of many people in terms of, the earlier slave trade, segregation and so forth. How do firms like this, did they play into it then? And how do you look at some of those things today?
Yes,
what's your perspective on some of that?
It's an important question. And I'm very clear in the book, and I've been, I think, pretty clear in interviews since, that there's no ands, ifs, or buts around the fact that Brown Brothers, at the time just Brown Brothers, they merged with Harriman in 1930, was the dominant cotton merchant of the 1830s, 1820s, 30s, and into the 1840s. And, Baltimore was a slave city, meaning it was legal to have enslaved people in Baltimore, although most of the inhabitants of Baltimore were actually freedmen. And that's, morally unambiguous, meaning it is an unequivocal moral evil that the cotton system and existed because of the labor of enslaved people. And Brown Brothers was complicit in that as a merchant. It's also true they were intensely anti-slavery. And I think people forget that one of the reasons that Lincoln is able to say on the eve of the Civil War that, you know, house divided cannot stand and a nation half free and half slave could not continue was that so much of the economy of the North and therefore so much of the economy of the entire country, not to mention, of course, the economy of the slave South, was embedded in a enslaved labor system, that there really was no half free. It was essentially an economy that was fueled by the labor of enslaved people. And if you believed that slavery was a moral evil, you just couldn't continue in any good faith to be complicit in that system. And Brown Brothers was very much of that issue. They wanted out. They wanted not to be in it. And the only way not to be in it was to end it. But until that happened, they were complicit.
Right. So they wanted out. They're abolitionist in nature, but they did profit a ton from the slave trade, which is just a fascinating part of America, isn't it? I mean, because it's hard not to. I guess it's probably overly simplification. There are probably lots of businesses that had nothing to do with the slave trade nor profited from it, and there are lots of businesses that didn't think of themselves as complicit in it, but probably did profit from it. I mean, there's probably a significant divide. It's not one broad brush, but it really is a fascinating situation where some businesses were against it but profited it. Some businesses weren't involved in it at all, didn't profit from it at all. Other businesses were all in, and there's probably some spectrum across the board there. What a fascinating situation.
I think even those businesses in the 1850s in the North that didn't directly profit from it, I mean, if you wore cotton clothing or you were in an ecosystem where trade was helping your urban environment, you know, in some way you were complicit, and therefore we all were.
It's an issue that transcends to this day in a different degree. If you're getting consumer goods from some place that's essentially using slave labor, you're still profiting from it. I mean,
exactly.
What other lessons are there from the book that transcend to modern day today? Like, what themes do you take out of it that are still very, you know, of interest today?
So the flip side, because ultimately the book, I think, is it derives lessons from the history of this particular firm and its role in society that I think are more positively applicable to our present day. And the key one there is that elites, you know, those with immense privilege, power, and fortune have a responsibility to the larger society, that you cannot endlessly pursue private profit and beggar the commons or ignore the common good, that in fact, those who profit mightily from a system have an obligation and a responsibility to serve the public good. Now, this is kind of part of the mantra of elites in American and to some degree English and other societies at the end of the 19th and into the early 20th century. You know, that's what they were taught at Yale and Groton, and a lot of this cohort goes to these very elite schools. But at these schools, they're taught, you know, you have a responsibility to serve the public good. And that coexisted with a very hierarchical, very elitist world. And I don't want to go back to that elitist world, right? I wouldn't have had a seat at those tables. I don't know if you would. And if you weren't born in the right place, to the right family, to the right position, it was very hard to enter that elite. But I do think that that lesson or that ethos of you cannot pursue private profit detached from public good, and that you can actually be, let's say, selfish, like want to make a lot of money in the financial world, and of service. Like that the of service is something that you can choose. And I do think a lot of our, you know, those who de facto are part of an elite today have kind of lost that message. Not all, and that's a generalization for sure, but it is, I think, an applicable and vital lesson of we do all live in one collective. We're in one society and there is a common good. And the idea that a company or an individual can pursue private gain and ignore that public good and not think, okay, what can I do to augment that public good? Because ultimately, you know, beggaring the commons doesn't work. That's a key lesson and very important for financial elites, I believe.
It's a fascinating message. I mean, it's a fascinating message on so many levels, because there's this complex mix between someone like Jeff Bezos, who's been so crazily fortunate, should also have that mindset of doing so much for society too. And he might say he does it anyway through his business ventures, but some of us would argue. But he's just an example. He's a paradigm example. But the concept being almost the old biblical concept, for those that have been given so much, they should be giving back so much as well. And it's this very fascinating mix of blend of motives in our country today, with where government fits into that, where the right private sort of mindset fits into that, what some of you should do because it's the right ethical and moral thing versus what they should be forced to do. And it's a fascinating discussion, isn't it, among societies? What is that social contract?
And I think that the answer, which you do hear a lot from companies and elites today, is I'm bettering the public good by pursuing the gain of this company, that the better this company does, the better the collective does. I think that's a profoundly insufficient answer. You know, that you actually do have to live that answer. You can't just punt and say, as a lot of tech elites say, well, what we're doing will benefit society, so I don't have to take any personal action beyond augmenting my company's success. Or a company can say, in that Milton Friedman-esque, like, our only responsibility is to augment the wealth of our shareholders. I think that's an insufficient answer, that earlier capitalists, like this kind of, you know, elite WASP, Brown Brothers culture, would have found very perplexing, right? They actually believed that they had a responsibility to the larger society. It's why a whole cohort of Brown Brothers partners at the middle of the 20th century entered government. It wasn't for power and influence. It was to kind of shape society and the world in a way that they thought would, yes, serve their own class and their interests, but would also be good for the global prosperity. You know, hence the Marshall Plan, hence a lot of the rules and systems of the post-war global system. And you can critique that, and there's a lot to critique about what those systems created. But I don't think you can critique some of the motivating spirit, which is both that biblical one or the Spider-Man view of history: with great power comes great responsibilities. And I think we need to live that more. You know, that's my own exhortation or my own lesson of the case. And it's throughout the book, I think, as well, how that plays itself out.
Yeah, and that's a great and important set of thoughts, isn't it? That in the old days, you would have felt, I'm doing my job by building a company that employs lots of people. I'm doing my job by taking care of my family. And that certainly are good pursuits and positive pursuits. But there's more than that, isn't there? There has to be more than that, doesn't there?
Exactly. I'm not an advocate of either wanting to go back. You know, the past is the past, whether we would want to go back or not. And you know, everything is a mixed bag, right? So the exclusionary aspect of Brown Brothers, whether it's the slavery complicity, whether it's their role in some more probably ultimately destructive forms of American imperialism in Central America, these are not things to hold up as models to emulate. But one of the great things about history is you kind of do get to pick and choose, meaning you get to say, yeah, there was a lot of complexity there that we are well done with. And then there are things that we've forgotten that we should remember. And there are ways of being that we could, you know, choose today. I'm a big believer in culture. And I'm also a big believer in the future is what we make of it. And it's the collection of a lot of decisions today. And we are clearly questioning the kind of shareholder finance capitalism that came to predominate in the late part of the 20th and into the early 21st century. And you can be, you know, enthusiastically capitalist and question that particular definition of capitalism and think like, okay, there are other ways that we could define, and there are other ways that companies could behave that would still serve the profit motive, but also serve lots of people and the overall society much more effectively.
No, absolutely. And this is this this is where we really have to go. It's some mix of being enthusiastically capitalist plus a lot more responsibility, too, if we're going to thrive as a society and so forth. I mean, that'd be my own perspective. It just can't be enthusiastically capitalist. That's a big part of it from my perspective, but it's got to be a lot more than that, too. There's got to be, it used to be called the social contract, that we have, that we thrive and we help. But somehow or another, that's got to be more institutionalized or ingrained in their society somehow or another.
Absolutely. And you're right to remind people of like the social contract, which used to have, was a phrase that had meaning, right? And it doesn't anymore. And that's fine. You know, things change. People reinvent words. They reinvent concepts. But there's a lot of people, you know, post-financial crisis of 2008, and certainly with the experience of the pandemic, where honestly that social contract was both incredibly tested, but also to some degree, maybe reinforced. I mean, it was the first time in my memory that, between state and national governments and companies, where there was a lot more attention paid to these are the times when we need to like financially support those who are struggling, what we need to, in terms of the workplace rules, support those who are challenged. I see a certain amount of good that has come out of this past pandemic period of both companies and government actually much more actively recognizing that it isn't just about the bottom line, and that we do have a responsibility to those who are negatively impacted by a hugely negative event.
100%. Zach Carabel, what a pleasure to visit with you. The book Inside Money, tell us where people can find the book and maybe the full name so we get people to the right place.
Sure. So it's Inside Money, Brown Brothers Harriman and the American Way of Power. It's published by Penguin, and you can buy it just about anywhere from Amazon, although I would definitely encourage people to go to their local independent bookstore. I have a soft spot for that. I think that's still important. And it's on audiobook and it's on Kindle. So if you have not had enough of my voice in this short amount of time, you can listen to me read the book for 17 hours on Audible or iBooks or any other form thereof.
Just magnificent. I see that you're a Harvard grad, also a philosophy major, Middle East studies. What a brilliant, brilliant background. Columbia University. I mean, what an amazing background academically. And then a contributing editor to Politico, Wired. What is River Twice Research?
It's more at this point River Twice Capital. It's just my own firm. Largely now I manage my own money and do my own investments. It had been a little more of a research firm, but it's more River Twice Capital. And I named it as such because there was an ancient Greek philosopher named Heraclitus who famously said, "You cannot step in the same river twice," as a way of articulating that life has changed, everything changes, and it's up to all of us every day to kind of recognize that change, embrace it, and try to figure it out. So hence River Twice.
Just fantastic, Zach. I love it. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Becker Private Equity and Business Podcast. Just a great pleasure to visit with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.